Landline. We're not available right now. Please leave a message after the beep. Thank you.
That's my voice on the answering machine from the early 2000s. I was no more than a kid and had the honor of speaking on behalf of the family. About 2 years after arriving in Cleveland, Ohio, my family and I found ourselves packing our bags yet again in a move that took us to Northwest Ohio. We moved into an apartment next to the interstate highway. The apartment was little. But then again, so was I. So the two bedrooms, a small kitchen with a counter that opens up to the living room slash dining room slash entryway, felt like ample space for us all. But the things that made Northwest Ohio home were the little things. It was the used Nintendo 64 brought home by my dad on a hot summer day, bought for next to nothing from a local family who listed it on Craigslist. As I recall, that little machine contains within it rich memories of playing GoldenEye with my dad and making friends or enemies in Mario Kart. In the end, we were inextricably tied together by 6-foot controller cords that all led back to this little box, a priceless gift from my father. Like father, like son, I too was pretty good at getting deals and roaming garage sales. My mom likes to remind me of what was apparently the proudest moment of my life. Imagine a 6-year-old boy dragging a box of free garage sale leftovers down the street along the sidewalk all the way back home. Cloth napkins, cutlery, miscellaneous kitchenware, candles, and what my mom fondly now calls junk. I was so excited to bring these treasures to our apartment and to do my part to make it home. These were the little things in life, the things that were insignificant in themselves, but so endlessly significant in what they meant to a family. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. I'm your host, Samuel Chang. Today, we're going to explore stories of connection, stories about games, about gathering places, about finding home. It's the little things, indeed, that bring us together. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home, and likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the third episode of Midstory's brand new podcast, Brain Drain, to take a deep dive into the difficult and complex decision to leave home, or likewise, to stay. Next, we're bringing to you a fascinating story of adaptive reuse, how what was once a grungy warehouse situated on prime waterfront real estate is now home to premium pickleball courts, a restaurant, and family-friendly activities. Then our writers do a deep dive into a game that you've likely played during the recent holidays, Euchre. Stay with us to learn about Euchre's origins and how it has become a stronghold of tradition in the Midwest. If you enjoy this program, be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. It's no secret that post-industrial cities like Toledo are struggling with depopulation. What are the reasons people leave? And what would convince them to stay? To answer these questions, we interviewed dozens of Toledoans, people who've left, people who've stayed, and everyone in between. Today, we're bringing you the next episode of Brain Drain, a new series from the team at Midstory. It's a podcast 7 years in the making, and at the core of why we came home. Episode 3 takes a look at Toledo's innovation scene, and how, despite Toledo's prosperous history of innovation and industry, the city has faced numerous setbacks in the present day and is still seeking its identity in a post-industrial world. Learn more about this podcast, explore data visuals, and tune in to future episodes at www.midstory.org/braindrain.
Towards the very beginning of our work on this podcast, I gave my friends Trevor and Hannah Lee a video call. They live in Bowling Green, about 30 minutes south of Toledo, with their 6-year-old daughter, Stevie.
Look who it is. Look at this.
Who is it, Mom?
You don't recognize me?
I forgot the name.
Oh, stop it.
The first time I met Stevie, I was working at my previous job at a coffee shop here in Toledo. But now I work at Midstory. Stevie says that's why she didn't recognize me at first.
It's okay.
You have a job!
I do! Believe it or not.
People can get jobs in the Midwest.
We're laughing, but Stevie's surprise isn't totally unwarranted. I went to high school in Bowling Green, then college in New York City, and never planned on coming back to Ohio. But like many people, during COVID, I came back. And what was intended as one summer turned into 4 years and counting. At first, I kept telling myself the move back was temporary. And then, when I discovered Midstory, I was really excited because it felt meaningful to be a part of an organization that is trying to make the place that we live in better. And I think because I lived in New York, I had that mentality of there's nothing worthwhile in Ohio or anywhere except New York. It was refreshing to be invited into a space that was trying to change that narrative. I realized I've always thought this place was special in its own way and worthy of investment. It just took someone saying it out loud to remind me of it. Well, and a job opportunity to make that real. Welcome to Brain Drain, a brand new Midstory production that presents the city of Toledo through the eyes of the people who've left it behind. I'm Daya Kukeli. Episode 3. I'm scrolling, and I'm learning a lot.
Out in California, it felt like we were kind of like treading water to get from A to B, or like here felt like
we can make goals and achieve them.
Yeah.
Because I'm not stressed about X, Y, and Z, like the cost of living or whatever it may be. I'm able to say yes to more social things and focus on the things that I love and explore the things that I'm excited about because I have more time and like room to be able to do that.
That's Trevor and Hannah again, who appreciate Northwest Ohio for perhaps its biggest selling point, affordability. They're what people around here call boomerangs.
I went to high school here in Northwest Ohio, went to college at BGSU for a while, and then eventually went out to college on the East Coast, came back to Ohio, and was in Colorado for a little bit and ended up out in California for 10 years before coming back to Ohio.
Hannah technically grew up near Sacramento. The combination of flexible jobs and having family nearby made moving to Northwest Ohio what she called a no-brainer.
When we started dating, I came out to Ohio for the first time to meet his family. And I was just like, oh, this is fantastic. And essentially, every time we came back to visit, it just got like harder and harder to leave. cost of living was a huge factor. Seeing the kind of life that we could like start building for ourselves and for our daughter out here was just like, that felt like a no-brainer to me.
Trevor is a photographer and works for a company remotely. Hannah is a writer and can do her job from anywhere. Trevor and Hannah might just be who Toledo is looking for. Toledo is trying to position itself as a prime destination for the workforce of the future. The city is trying to develop a bit of a tech scene and wants to attract remote workers who are looking for an affordable place to live. According to the U.S. Census, there were 8,489 remote workers in Toledo in 2024. That's about 7% of Toledo's employed working population. But that's the lowest rate among Ohio's major cities, with Columbus at more than double the rate of remote workers at over 16%. Cities like Cleveland and Cincinnati sit around 10 to 12%. Even Dayton and Akron beat out Toledo for remote workers. If you're from Ohio, you know how much of a diss that is. When compared to major U.S. cities with much higher cost of living, Toledo still lags behind. 12.5% of New York City's employed working population works remotely, 15.5% of Boston's, and 17.6% of Chicago's. So consider this. Remote workers who, by definition, can in most cases live just about anywhere, would rather pay sky-high rent to live in New York City or Chicago than move to a much more affordable place like Toledo. And when I say more affordable, I mean a lot more affordable. When I moved back to Toledo from New York and went to the grocery store for the first time to stock up our fridge and pantry, I experienced huge sticker shock, in a good way. What I expected to be about $500 worth of groceries was $250. That's the moment I realized, yeah, this is gonna be nice. I've also since bought a home in Toledo, something I couldn't even remotely imagine doing in New York. Toledo's been named one of America's most affordable housing markets for multiple years in a row. And the cost of living in the Glass City sits around 14% less than the national average. But it's a whopping 48.7% less than Boston and 36.3% less than Chicago. Even in Ohio, it's 21.1% less than Columbus, 17.8% less than Cincinnati, and 19.8% less than Cleveland.
We saw an influx of wonderful talent come in during the pandemic with remote work, and we saw that people could do their jobs, right? Like, it's not necessarily about like butts and seats. It's about the work you do and the accountability. There's still like a lot of great opportunity here, and it's a great home base for like that adventurous spirit too. Like, you know, I think, you know, rent has gone up across the country, but rent is still very affordable compared to any of those big cities that you're going to move to.
That's Teresa Atella, one half of another young couple I talked to for this episode. They recently came back to Ohio after spending a few years in Austin, Texas. Her husband, Jason, is from Akron and left because he thought he could only experience that sense of adventure elsewhere. Though things weren't always great for Teresa's job in Austin.
I was making sometimes less than what I was making here. And the nonprofit, because there's a lot of startups and small business tech, but there's no big tech in Austin. So there's not a lot of corporations like giving back to these nonprofits to like make that. So I actually struggled a lot in my professional career while I was in Austin.
Due to Teresa's job and their desire to start a family, they moved back to Ohio. In Ohio, they found more support and an affordable house. Unlike the Lee family, however, there have been some regrets with their return back home.
For me, it'd be like on the tech industry, lack of opportunities. Like if you want to do something local here, it's like I look online for jobs and there's not many opportunities. So I'm going to go south, Austin or west, or even probably Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities there, but in Ohio, there's not as many tech opportunities.
Keyword, opportunities. Ironically, people once flocked to Ohio for the jobs it supported, especially in Toledo. In the second half of the 19th century, the city's population grew 80-fold in 50 years. By 1890, it was a bustling hub of industry and transportation, boasting a population of 81,434 people. From 1910 to 1970, the percentage of the Black population in Toledo more than tripled, as Black Americans moved from the South in the Great Migration to find wartime jobs that were opened up as the industrial North ramped up production work. Toledo was truly at the forefront of what was then the world's tech industry.
All right, well, you ride that bike, you're going to lose some pounds, but how would you know unless you had a scale?
My Jeep CJ is the toughest rig around. My Jeep CJ can take yours anytime.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Toledo was where bicycles became motor cars, where glass blowing became glass bottles, which then became glass blocks for buildings, that then became fiberglass for insulation and numerous other applications that have fundamentally shaped the way we live. Famous innovations such as the Toledo Scale and the Jeep, and lesser known but nonetheless revolutionary ones such as the Zero ice cream scoop, the atomizer, and the compression sock that could probably be found in every other household today, were innovated and made in Toledo. Soon after the Second World War, however, the wartime manufacturing and post-war housing bubble burst. Companies moved out from the city cores. Many went overseas. The Toledo of today is a shell of its yesterday. But in the past few decades, there have certainly been efforts to rekindle the flame of innovation. Nonetheless, for Toledoans who've been around long enough to remember, the endings to these stories are predictable, at best. In 1980, Toledo had 7 Fortune 500 companies, 5 of which were located downtown. Throughout the early 2000s, a few of them moved to the suburbs, others were sold or absorbed, and by 2008, only one remained, Owens Corning. In 2012, Hickory Farms, a gourmet food company founded by Toledo native Richard Ransom, promised to move its headquarters downtown. In 2017, after 65 years supporting hundreds of workers in Northwest Ohio, they relocated to Chicago. The then CEO, Diane Pierce, said of the move, quote, "We determined that in order to take Hickory Farms to the next level, we need to get to a world-class city with great talent." In 2021, Peloton promised to build a $400 million facility in Northwest Ohio, and then in 2022, pulled the plug as the pandemic waned and people headed back to in-person gyms. Also in 2021 was one of the most infamous broken promises of Toledo's recent years, a promise that ended in bankruptcy, corruption, and a big empty building in the heart of downtown. Bitwise was a California-based startup with a founder from Toledo. They were looking to invest money in cities that had a lot of talent and potential for tech jobs, like Toledo. Bitwise planned to bring in 378 jobs and culled a series of investments, partnerships, loans, federal tax credits, and grants to support $38 million of renovations that would transform the historic Jefferson Center into co-working and event spaces. It was estimated that these investments would contribute $20 million in new annual payroll to the community. It seemed too good to be true. Spoiler alert, it was.
Before we begin with your top Ford for some breaking details, a University of Toledo grad and co-founder of failed tech startup Bitwise are about to appear in court in California on federal fraud charges.
On June 1st, 2023, the board of directors fired the co-CEOs, one of whom was University of Toledo grad Irma L. Olgan Jr. All 900 employees of the company were furloughed, and Bitwise Industries filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. A little over a year later, Olgan Jr. was sentenced to 9 years in prison after being investigated by the FBI and IRS for her part in the $115 million fraud that was Bitwise Industries. The dream of revitalizing the Jefferson Center came to a crashing halt, leaving a sour taste in the mouth of Toledoans, and leaving downtown with a big empty building and investors with a hole in their pocket.
I am a Toledo native, born and raised in Toledo. I'm 42 years old. I'm 42 years old. Been married 16 years at this point, and I got four kids.
Meet LaShawn Shaw, a local entrepreneur and champion of the tech community in Northwest Ohio. Oh, and he's also a former VP of Bitwise.
And, you know, to be honest, you know, some of what happened with Bitwise was a disappointment. It is super unfortunate that the idea of what they were trying to create in that innovation district, or even just as a business as a whole, you know, did not come to fruition. You know, the initial idea for the Innovation Post was that there were going to be hundreds of companies that were going to work out of the Innovation Post, and that it was going to be a community center and people could come there and get free Wi-Fi, and that you could, you know, go there and, you know, check out different tech events.
LaShawn describes the ending of his job as tragic, but somehow he also found beauty in the aftermath of the Bitwise debacle. For LaShawn, it wasn't a wasted effort. Toledo was still brimming with potential.
So many of the community partners that believed in that idea of what that innovation district could be invested in the Jefferson Center and made that into a beautiful building, you know, and that's exactly what it is today. It still stands as a beautiful building. It is not the tech hub that, you know, it was initially meant to be, but it's not for lack of trying. I think what it did was also give us an idea of what was possible. And for a while, a lot of people believed in that possibility as well too. And what we're really trying to do is reignite that idea of what's possible.
LaShawn isn't alone in his efforts to revitalize the tech scene since that painful moment in recent Toledo memory. Just 8 blocks down the road in the historic Woolworth Building at the heart of downtown, in another property formerly occupied by Bitwise, sits the newly minted Toledo Tech Loft, a co-working and event space founded by Chris Eichen in 2024 to recoup some of the tech momentum lost from Bitwise's fall from grace. The burden of that legacy hasn't been lost on Chris. At this point, I'd like to introduce Rajan Carson, a Midstory intern, who joined me to explore Toledo's current tech scene.
Hi, my name is Rajan. I am from Atlanta, Georgia, and I've lived there my entire life. And I'm a rising senior at Duke University.
While downtown, he stopped at the Toledo Tech Loft.
We waited and hung out kind of towards the back a little bit, just trying to get a sense of like the vibes there and trying to see who's in charge. We couldn't find any actual employees. Honestly, I would say I was pleasantly surprised. At first when I walked in, it did seem pretty empty. There was a cafe area in the back and there was a lot of laptops and bags strewn around everywhere. And I was like kind of confused as to where everyone was. But as I ventured deeper into the loft, I noticed that everyone is kind of gathered in one of these classrooms for a meeting. And I think this kind of just shows the success of not just the co-working space, but also the event space we're having. After waiting maybe 5 or 10 minutes, we actually ran into Chris as we were about to leave. And he is, I would say, a very charismatic entrepreneur vibes, right? Here's how he describes his space in his own words.
Yeah, when you first walk in, it's a bright blue, big open, you know, concept space with open ceilings, like with the exposed ventilation and things. You have big open co-working, and then there's a space in the back that's a little separated for co-working, but that's like a quiet co-working area. We have 2 classrooms, one right when you walk in, and then the others tucked away in the back, but it's got some beautiful windows when you go in there.
Although there were people there, the founder was mentioning that tech opportunities in the area remain limited. I kind of got that impression too, as most of the workers I talked to weren't actually working in tech.
There's few of those opportunities currently, but one of the things that we're doing is creating more of those opportunities. The infrastructure for that looks a lot different than I think what the region's used to. We're used to big factories and needing all these like square feet to facilitate some of this stuff. It's a culture. You know, these companies aren't just going to move here for the fun of it because it's cheap. They're going to want to move here because there's a culture to move to.
The Toledo Tech Loft bills itself as a vibrant community where innovation flourishes and collaboration drives progress. Michael Vanderpool is a regular at the Toledo Tech Loft, embracing this new co-working space. He teaches at Defiance College in nearby Defiance, Ohio.
We have an immense amount of untapped talent here, you know, in the universities here downtown, but then also like regionally, just in going to the rural parts of Northwest Ohio. And what's awesome is there are people who love where they're at and don't want to leave. They just need the opportunity to show off what they can actually really do. I was very surprised when I first started teaching there. My initial impression was everybody wanted to get the heck out of town. 70% of them wanted to stay. That's when my mission changed from, okay, I need to prepare you for leaving or transferring or going into something else. And it became, okay, I need to make the region aware of what talent you have and abilities you have so you can find a place here because you want to stay here.
For Michael, the most important thing the Toledo community can do is help young people start their own ventures.
With or without growing jobs, we just need to empower these young people to make their own way. Maybe they start their own companies, maybe they do their own things and aren't necessarily waiting for some company to come find them. You know, we've got an awesome tech community, we have an awesome arts community, we've got an awesome film community. We have all these little pockets of people who are doing some amazing stuff.
LaShawn agrees with Michael about the promise of energetic and talented young people in the region. Still, he has questions on how to keep them here.
Unfortunately, I feel as if Toledo has a lot of fast followers, but not early enablers. You know, so if there's a really good idea that maybe someone young has, or a tech company has, or a startup or entrepreneur has, and you bring this idea to the table and people don't maybe have an understanding or have an affinity for it, a lot of times people are just going to try and find that community elsewhere. And you can't really blame them for doing that. You know, I see a lot of really successful companies that are in other cities that were started by people that are from Toledo, Ohio. And they may not want to bring those companies back to Toledo, Ohio because of the brain drain that they had to go through, you know, while they were here. And that makes it really, really hard because for an entrepreneur, just being an entrepreneur is not easy, period.
LaShawn, Chris, and Michael are all part of an ever-growing network of tech movers and shakers in Toledo. From hosting local tech events to organizing the biggest AI conference in Northwest Ohio, they hope their contributions can make a difference. They are all happy and proud to call this region their home, even with its challenges.
This has been great. I have one more question. Have you ever considered leaving Toledo? And if so, why?
I consider leaving Toledo like every day. you know, that's just an honest answer. And a lot of times I consider leaving Toledo because, and I may have this idea, like maybe it would be easier. You know, maybe the ideas that I have would be adopted, you know, quicker if I were to go somewhere else. Maybe I could get funding easier if I were to go somewhere else. Maybe I could get more support and not feel like it's such a drag or pull to get people to do really innovative things that are going to be able to bring attention, return on, you know, investment to my city. I'd be lying if I said I don't think about that consistently. I have a family, but or what somebody will offer me in another city, I would do the exact same thing here for half, you know, just because of the love of the city, for the love of the people, and for the understanding that if somebody at some point doesn't pave that road, then we're just going to continuously, you know, have the exact same issues, and we're going to lose time, we're going to lose money, we're going to lose effort, we're going to lose people. And I just don't want to see that happen for Toledo.
Chris feels the same, that ultimately we have to be the change we want to see.
My kids are why I'm here, and knowing that my kids are here drove me to say, okay, if I want Toledo to be a city that I really want to live in, I can't point fingers and blame this, that, or the other. I need to create it. And if I'm going to do it, I'm going to give it everything I have. And so I know that I have like certain talents that I was born with. And so it's leveraging those talents to like inspire and motivate people to hop on board with my dream.
The next generation of the city's economy will take time to mature. The vacant buildings throughout downtown are still waiting for their offices, businesses, and workers.
Progress is a process. You know, that's one of the things that I always tell individuals, you know, it's going to take time, you know, in order to get, you know, where we want to be as a community, or as entrepreneurs or whatever it may be. And to enjoy that process, you know, and to discover the beauty within that process and to share that process.
Some locals like Trevor and Hannah Lee have come to appreciate that feeling too.
I would just say out here, I feel like creatively it's worked really well for me because I just have this freedom to kind of do what I want. It's like a blank canvas because most of it hasn't been told. It's not like spelled out for me. So I think creatively, you just have to be in the right mindset here of being able to pursue and tell a story that you want to tell and create what you want to create.
I mean, what I have found here is that I have so much more mental, emotional, social energy and capacity to like make more out of my life, even though you could argue that there is less happening here, you know? Because we have like the financial resources. So you could put roots down if you wanted, or you could, you know, I don't know. It just seems like a great spot. I really like it.
Thank you guys so much.
No, it was fun talking with you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
I'm so grateful to you guys for doing this. Seriously.
Yeah. We will be 100 infinity 7 million million infinity infinity 7.
Even though you don't know me at all.
Dad, don't say that. Oh,
okay. Can we go get dinner ready?
To see you.
Brain Drain is a Mid-Story podcast written and hosted by Yannick Schaller and by me, Dea Kukeli. Additional reporting on this episode by Rajan Carson. Our editors are Logan Sander and Samuel Chang. Sound design and engineering on this episode is by Samuel Chang. Original artwork for the series by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. Data analysis by Taisha Tsui, Anna Diasio, and Yitong Jung. Fact-checking by Terry Brisky. Special thanks go to our lovely team of interns who called Toledo home for at least a summer. Anavi Prakash, Yazu Shinazaki, Rajan Carson, Martin Barreto, and Desiree Lua. For more information, research, and reading material, please check out the show notes for this episode, available at midstory.org/braindrain. If our reporting has struck a chord or a nerve, we want to hear from you. Reach us on social media or via email at braindrain@midstory.org. Thanks for listening.
Enjoyed this podcast episode? Brain Drain and the many stories produced by MidStory are made possible in part by listeners like you. To support Midwest Stories and help us uplift our home, check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the MidStory Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org/themidstoryhour or wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's next story is part of Withstanding, a mini-documentary series and exhibition featuring six adaptive reuse projects from across Ohio. From bustling North Columbus to quiet Kings Mills, from Northeast Ohio's Cleveland and Oberlin to the glass capital of the world, Toledo, join us as we uncover stories of Ohioans' creativity and innovation. These sites, ranging from schools to warehouses to factories, reflect how our past has been shaped by the forces of industry, migration, education, and more. And their transformation shows how Ohioans are reimagining the future of our state's built heritage. 2 years ago, Toledo Pickle was just one of many nondescript buildings on the waterfront of Toledo. Today, the building, formerly used by the City of Toledo's maintenance department, provides food and fun while helping grow the sport of pickleball in the city. A public-private partnership turned underutilized space into a new gem of the waterfront, opening up residents' access to the river and speaking to the broader potential of post-industrial Toledo. Here's that story now.
It's the fastest growing sport in America. Easy to learn, difficult to master. And tennis snobs absolutely hate it. I'm sure you've heard of it by now. Yes, quite literally heard of it. We're talking about
pickleball.
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 The New York Times recently analyzed nearly 100,000 aerial photographs and found that more than 8,000 tennis courts had been transformed for pickleball. Today, the USTA says at least 10% of tennis courts in America have been taken over and repurposed for pickleball. But in Toledo, Ohio, a different kind of takeover is happening in a giant metal box on the Maumee River.
Where Real Seafood and all those restaurants over there, that was city property. And that's where they stored trucks and salt. And Cardi Finkbeiner called me one day, he was the mayor, and said, "This is the worst use of riverfront property I've ever seen. We want to clean up the river. We want to make it something for families and fun. And we'd love you to come down and build some restaurants here." And so we did that. Interestingly then, after deciding this was the worst use of riverfront property for this type of thing, what did they do? They built this building, and they moved everything that was over there into this building. So now we're looking at this again, saying this is the worst use of riverfront property.
Several years ago, we went through a benchmarking process to really compare our community, the communities that we compete with across the country. And that exercise showed us one glaring truth, and that we were using the most important investment that we had, an asset that we had, which was our public accessible riverfront, in some of the worst ways possible at that time. And so we committed as a community to change that.
For most of the 20th century, this site had been home to industrial warehouses, owned by various building material and manufacturing companies. In the early 90s, this particular warehouse stored salt piles and trucks for the city. And for the next 20 years, it was known as the Streets, Bridges, and Harbor Building.
Yeah, so the site we're sitting on, not unlike almost every inch of our riverfront, is on top of fly ash or buried old rail lines. I mean, this is a Rust Belt city, and it is almost entirely comprised of, you know, our industrial legacy. People didn't have access to the river. They would have had to walk a mile down the road and a half mile back just to get near the water.
Toledo has been trying to develop its riverfront for decades. Investor after investor made promise after promise. Nothing ever seemed to stick. But in April 2017, something new was brewing. Metro Parks Toledo purchased the Marina District across the river and began developing the Glass City Riverwalk. The plan was to create a greenway to bring the city back to the waterfront. That's where Toledo Pickle comes in. The Metro Parks and the city entered into a public-private partnership with Toledo Pickle to include the building as part of the Riverwalk, connecting downtown to the Vistula neighborhood.
The Metro Parks does two things, right? We take care of globally ecologically important green space, and then we connect people to it. However, we don't need to carry the torch for activation. This space is not only saves an old building that essentially was 40,000 square feet of riverfront as a garage, but it brings tens of thousands of people to it, getting them outside, coming back downtown again.
I went to Dallas, I went to Kansas City and looked at some different facilities that were being built. And a lot of them are just pickleball facilities. And I felt like, well, we want to do more than that. You know, so we decided we want to build a family entertainment center. There's pickleball, down here is going to be a rock climbing wall. And then over here, there'll be some basketball machines, shooting machines, and skee ball. We have a mezzanine over this whole area. We've got 6 courts on this side and only 3 on this side. And we could have squeezed these this way and decided, you know what, let's make this a really nice socializing area. We've got trees, we've got couches and tables and chairs where people can sit and talk. The entire place will be a restaurant. We can deliver it to you, you can go pick it up, whatever you want to do.
You know, when we started thinking about the concept and where we'd be, where would we put it in Northwest Ohio, Southeast Michigan, we could have been off the highway somewhere and could have been a destination place, but you weren't going to impact as many people in the community with that. Being a part of this downtown revitalization was really important for us.
Toledo Pickle is located on the edge of the very first neighborhood in Toledo, Vistula.
One of the things about Vistula neighborhood is there is no third space. There's no public school. There's no library, there's no YMCA. And so when you look at spaces that people feel safe and they want to congregate with their neighbors, like there aren't those spaces in Vistula.
When the idea was first launched to the area, myself, like a lot of others, were pickleball in this area. And I had my reservations about it. And when we talked to a couple of young people, they didn't even know what pickleball was. But I did meet with the owners and the developers, and they, once they explained it, that it's not just pickleball down there. It can be interactive for everyone in the neighborhood. I'm happy about the development off the river. I am one of those people that believe the liveliness is always around the water. And so when we have development and it's not just a vacant space in the area, that's a good thing because everything around that at some point will be developed.
From a salt and truck warehouse to a communal gathering place, the story of 1030 Water Street is about much more than just an up-and-coming sport.
We're forming partnerships like what you're seeing here tonight to activate all of this space. The goal in a few years is to have the country's best river walk, and I think this facility is an example of how we're going to attain that goal, and I think something we should all be proud of.
3, 2, 1.
This is about breaking down barriers in every conceivable way of that phrasing. We want people to return to the river and celebrate who we are as opposed to who we are not.
Toledo's been a great community to live in, to raise a family. I love it. And I just wanted to see great things happen here.
I don't recognize downtown even from 5 years ago when I, you know, 10 years ago when I was working down here. And we won't recognize it again in another 5 years. We're just gonna be a part of it.
This story was adapted for audio from one of our documentaries. If you'd like to watch the video version of this piece, as well as the documentaries for the other 5 sites featured in this project, visit midstory.org/withstanding. Withstanding is funded in part by the America 250 Ohio Commission and the Ohio Arts Council. This project is also supported in part by the Arts Commission and the City of Toledo and Lucas County.
The Midstory Hour is a weekly radio show by Midstory, where we connect regional stories to national dialogues and feature behind-the-story conversations with Midstory's writers from across the nation. Tune in to WGTE on FM 91 every Saturday at 10 a.m. And find the podcast online at mintstory.org/the Mint Story Hour and wgte.org/the Mint Story Hour or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to The Mid-Story Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org/the Mid-Story Hour or wgte.org/the Mid-Story Hour or wherever you get your podcasts. If you're from the Great Lakes region, it's likely that you grew up with euchre, maybe playing at family reunions or when there wasn't much else to do during high school or college. It's also likely that if you ever mentioned it to people from outside the so-called euchre belt, you were met with blank stares. But this card game once enjoyed a much larger player base. During the 19th century, euchre was the American game, with one tournament drawing over 2,000 players. Summer intern Joshua Repp wanted to see just how influential the game still is today. To find out, he spoke to small-town devotees, collegiate club organizers, and world champions. He discusses the game and its legacy with reporter Celia Johnson. Here's their conversation.
If you're not from the Great Lakes states, you might not have heard of the card game euchre, because it's really only stuck around in those areas. I wrote a story investigating euchre's origin, its popularity, and subsequent falloff, and, this might surprise you, its current revival in some locations.
Great, Josh. Well, let's start with the basics.
How do you play it?
Yeah, so euchre is a trick-taking card game, typically played with four players on two teams. So there's some strategy involved. You sit across from your partner, so you have to know them.
And do you play?
I do play. I grew up watching my family play, and then as I grew up, they kind of taught me as well.
And what got you interested in writing the article?
Yeah, I was interested in looking at euchre as a form of social glue, especially in the Midwest, because that's how I observed it in my own life. And then also, as I just researched into it, I was really fascinated by the history of euchre.
So a term you use in the article is the euchre belt, which comprises six states. Is that right?
That's right. So it includes Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania. But it is kind of controversial. Some people say that their states should be included, such as Wisconsin and also Canada.
And how did euchre come to America in general?
Well, euchre has its origin in an Alsatian game called Jucker. And this kind of originated in Alsatia and Southwest Germany. And then it was brought over to America by German immigrants. So a lot of them came over during the 19th century, especially between 1815 and 1848, over 500,000.
Yeah, I know Cincinnati, has a large German population, so that makes sense. And do we still see connections to that German heritage in the game today?
Well, one example can be found in the Jack of the Trump suit, which is the highest ranking card, and it's called the Bauers. And then the term comes from the German word Bauer. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it means farmer or peasant. And so while the name was already present in older games, it kind of is emblematic of euchre's elevation of the lowly farmer to the most powerful card game, like the same way as German immigrants hope for a better life.
And then so it came in the early half of the 1800s, does that seem fair to say? Mm-hmm. But then it seems like it didn't get super popular until the second half of that
That's
century.
That's right.
So what did that kind of success look like for a card game?
Well, the first recorded mention of euchre is in 1829, and then just after this, it really took off. So it was known as the American card game. And in 1862, it was described as the most fascinating and entertaining of all the games of cards yet invented. So it really just took off after that.
Yeah, it sounds like people really enjoyed playing it. So was that mostly, in living rooms, or were there also kinds of, public places for people to play?
It was definitely in living rooms and public places, but there was also like a bigger component to it. So one example is in 1898, there was a massive tournament of euchre, which drew over 2,000 players to New York City. And so it acted as a fundraiser, but also the top 150 players won pieces of jewelry. So it was more than just something simple.
Wow, yeah, that speaks to a lot of popularity for the game.
Yeah.
So, why is it mostly only played in those six states today? How did we get from there to here?
Well, Euchre was brought by German immigrants, and an interesting thing about the Euchre Belt, as we call it, is that it also correlates to places with a lot of German heritage. So that's one theory about why it stuck around. And then another aspect is that it was also overshadowed by games like poker and bridge. And one person compares it to polka music in Wisconsin. It's just one example of like a cultural remnant from the past that is still embraced today.
Oh, that's very interesting. I didn't know they were into polka in Wisconsin. So within, you know, the Euchre Belt, I imagine not everyone plays the card game. So what kinds of communities are still keeping Euchre traditions alive?
Well, as you might expect, a lot of small towns still play this, and it brings a lot of people together. So I did talk to Bill Chappell from the Monrovia Festival and Community Association. And so Monrovia, Indiana is an agricultural town, and it has less than 2,000 inhabitants. And so if you go on Google Maps, you won't find a lot there. But the thing about Monrovia is that they bring together a loyal band of Euchre players. These people just really know the routine, and they come every month to just play. And so I'll read you one quote from him. He said, "You'd laugh. They know where the routine. They know where every game is. They know where they're going the next day and everything. It's like a traveling circus with them, and it gives them something to do."
Huh. And they play once a week, twice a week?
They play 5-6 days a week.
Wow, actually. That's a lot of Euchre. And then one other community you also spoke to for the article was college students, which I was a little surprised to see. I think you don't generally think of, you know, the kinds of people who play Euchre in small towns, and college students is having much in common. So, I mean, were you surprised to see that as well?
Yeah, I was surprised, actually. So if you look at Monrovia, there's a lot of old people playing. And so I was surprised to hear about these people playing on college campuses. And what I found was I talked to the OSU Euchre Club advisor. He told me that it really brings together staff and students, so there's a lot of generational mixing in there.
That's very interesting. And is OSU the only place where people are playing this game?
It's definitely not. I also talked to Sam Petsky, an undergrad student at Northwestern, and he told me about how his family played it in Wisconsin and when he went to Northwestern. He just wanted to find a way to make new friends and invite people to come together. So this is one way to do it.
That's great. I mean, you talked a little bit earlier about Euchre as social glue. It definitely seems to be an example of that. All right. Well, so people are playing in community centers. They're playing in colleges. And this sounds like a lot of fun. But are there people who take it, well, I don't want to say more seriously. I'm sure those people take it very seriously. But, you know, like that tournament you talked about in the 1890s, right? Are there people playing for money, for jewelry, for glory?
There is, actually. And I was really surprised to find that there is actually a World Euchre Tournament. And this is what makes me think that it's kind of a revival, because it started in 2023, so pretty recently. And it's housed in New Glarus, Wisconsin. So I talked to the 2025 doubles winners, Joseph Ebling and Matthew Morshes. And so they told me just how surprising it is to play at family functions and maybe at a bar, and then come to this competition and find so many people just really passionate about Euchre.
Yeah, and what was competing in a tournament like for them?
Well, they told me how they met at Purdue University, but really only started playing Euchre competitively at their local bar's weekly Euchre night in Chicago.
Why did New Glarus decide to host this tournament?
So the interesting thing about the tournament is that it was actually a fundraiser, so it helped fund the town's first dog park in 2025, actually.
Oh, so it's giving back to the community as well. That's great. We have our own community of readers here at Midstory, and I know that when you published this story, you heard from quite a few of them. So tell me what that was like.
After I finished writing the story, it was posted online, and it turns out that a lot of people wanted to share their opinion. So it kind of went viral, and a lot of people sent it to their old Euchre friends. They wanted to reminisce a little bit. And then a lot of people insisted that their states and Canada as well should be included in the Euchre Belt.
So a little controversial, but also a lot of people appreciating the work that you
did. Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure that's a nice feeling. Did anyone share anything that stood out with you?
Yeah, people were sharing a lot of their high school and college memories, especially in the 90s and 2000s. I can read you a few of their comments. One says, "I was stranded at an airport with two other people. One guy stood up and yelled, 'Anyone want to play Euchre?' A guy about 20 feet away stood up and said, 'I'm from Ohio.' He never actually said yes, but we knew exactly what he meant."
That's a great anecdote. Yes. I think that really shows what you were saying about, you know, how it remains a firmly cultural tradition in these states.
A lot of the comments also were just remarking about how when they went to college in the 90s or 2000s, every single party had a Euchre game at them. It was maybe something you didn't have to think too hard about, just to have fun with some friends.
Yeah. So maybe it's been experiencing a low-level revival for a couple decades.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, very interesting. Well, thank you for coming and sharing your story, Josh.
Thanks, it was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the Mid-Story Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about Mid-Story, our home, and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share, or just would like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, see you soon. The Mid-Story Hour is a Mid-Story podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted by Samuel Chang, edited by Evan Blanco, and written by Logan Sander, Ruth Chang, and Samuel Chang. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Reb. This week's episode features stories by the Greater Mid-Story team, including Dea Kukeli, Yannick Schaller, Celia Johnson, and Yaffa Siegel. Mid-Story is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, Mid-Story re-envisions the Midwest story toward a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.
The Mid-Story Hour is a weekly radio show by Mid-Story, where we connect regional stories to national dialogues and feature behind-the-story conversations with Mid-Story's writers from across the nation. Tune in to WGTE on FM 91 every Saturday at 10 a.m. and find the podcast online at midstory.org/themidstoryhour and wgte.org/themidstoryhour or wherever you listen to podcasts.